Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what's behind Governor Ducey's decision to follow Texas's lead and bus migrants to D.C.?
And researchers are trying to figure out why some people haven't gotten COVID and what it could mean for future viruses.
But first, work continues at the state capitol, albeit at a far slower pace than earlier in the session. There are still a number of bills awaiting votes, and of course, lawmakers face a June 30th deadline to pass a new state budget. With me, as he is every Monday during the session, to talk about what to expect this week at 1700 West Washington, is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, it seems COVID and the pandemic are very much on the minds of state lawmakers this week, with a trio of bills that'll be coming up. And let me ask you about one of them, which basically says the state health department can't add a requirement for students to be vaccinated against COVID-19 as one of those vaccines you have to get to go to school. Is this something districts were actually considering doing?
Well, no, and it isn't even something that the districts can mandate. This is something the state health department has a list of things that you need to get into school, you know, rubella, measles, mumps, things like that, you know, highly contagious childhood diseases. Now, remember, there are already opt-outs for parents. You can use a medical exemption, you can use a religious exemption, or you can even use a personal exemption. I'm just opposed to it. Now, of course, the other side of that is if there's an outbreak, you've got to keep your kid out of school. Nobody has been looking at this in terms of adding COVID to that, but this sort of fits into the area of folks who are just convinced that A, COVID is fake, or B, the vaccines are dangerous. And so they've decided to tie the hands of the health department no matter what. It's going to be interesting to see what the governor does with that, because the governor, in fact, had killed a couple of bills a few years ago that would have made it easier for parents to opt out, because he said, I'm a believer in vaccines. Now, what he believes about the COVID vaccine, he's obviously was urging people to get vaccinated and for a while to even wear masks. So hard to know what he will do with that. But that is coming up today in the Senate among, as you point out, a couple of other vaccine bills.
Yeah, let me ask you about one of those other bills. And this one deals with masks and there seems to be some overlap with an earlier bill from this session. This would basically say the government cannot require minors to wear masks.
Yes, there's a couple of bills, as you point out, that were passed either last year or this year. For example, one says private businesses are not required to enforce mask mandates on patrons. Another that barred local governments from imposing mask mandates. There was another bill this year that bans masks on students absent parental approval. This is even broader than that. This says that any government agency cannot require anyone under 18 to wear a mask into a government building absent parental approval. I don't know that there's been a problem with that. It's taking in all government agencies, including the courts, and saying, no, you can't do that. The only exception in there is, for example, if you're going into a place that has a sort of longstanding health or safety requirements. For example, I suppose a county-run hospital could say, if you want to come in, you'd have to wear a mask. Then there's a related bill that also deals with adults and mask mandates in government buildings. This has been, you know, one of those culture checkpoints here for a lot of folks in terms of both the vaccines and the masks. And a lot of it shows, you know, what do you believe? What do you believe about masks? What do you believe about vaccines? And what do you believe, I suppose, about Dr. Fauci?
Right. So, Howie, one other interesting bill coming up early this week. This deals with dogs and discrimination. And I will be honest, as a non-pet owner, I did not realize that dogs were subject to discrimination. But this seems to be about not using just the type of breed to sort of judge a book by its cover, it seems like.
That's exactly it. The issue has been that some insurance companies, when they're writing homeowners insurance or renters insurance, say, oh, you've got a pit bull or you have some other dog that we consider to be dangerous. Therefore, we either A, not write a liability policy for the dog, or B, we'll charge you something else. So what they say is you can consider the breed, but that can't be the only issue there. So it's not a question of, you know, you're a pit bull, therefore you're guilty. I mean, I've seen some really nasty chihuahuas. So, you know, the size, you know, doesn't matter there. And then they've also tacked on some provisions that say if cases go to court, where it's a dog bite case, that the jury cannot consider solely the breed of the dog to decide whether an owner is liable for not controlling the dog. This has been a longstanding issue among a lot of pet owners, particularly those who own the quote-unquote dangerous breeds. And a lot of people are saying it's not the dog, it's how the dog is trained. Now, there probably are some breeds that are more aggressive. You don't find a lot of Labradoodles going out and attacking people. But I suppose if you properly trained a Labradoodle, you could make an attack dog also. So this is one of those non-discrimination bills, but dealing with animals. Of course, me, I'm a cat owner, so I don't worry about that.
So, Howie, it is Monday morning, which compels me to ask, here on the 16th of May, are we any closer to a budget?
Oh, come on. You keep asking this.
Like
you keep expecting a different answer. Look, just because today is day 127 of the 100-day session doesn't mean we're closer. I mean, we are closer to the extent that we all believe that by June 30th, when the fiscal year ends, or at least a day or two after that, we will have a budget. Remember, this isn't like the federal government where they can pass a continuing resolution to keep things going. Things shut down on July 1st. If, in fact, we have no budget. Now, they're not going to open the prison doors. DPS isn't going to stop patrolling the highways. You're not free to travel 120 miles an hour on I-10. But there are some things that will happen. Parks may close. Certain government offices may close if they don't do that. The problem is coming up with the proverbial 16 senators, 31 House members, and the governor. The Republicans would like to do it as an all-Republican budget. The problem there, though, is that you have some Republicans who want things in the budget, whether it's additional money for K-12, whether it's their opposition to certain things that other folks want, like expansion of vouchers. So now they have to see if they go to the Democrats, but the Democrats have their own price, and they don't want the expansion of vouchers in general, although a few Democrats are probably willing to support it. But they're just trying to build this coalition. We'll know more, you know, later today, because for the last couple of weeks, they come in on Monday and then they come back on Thursday, or sometimes they're gone a whole week. We will know by the end of the day today, depending on when they bring folks back, whether they're anywhere closer. I'm not holding my breath. I am assuming that I don't go on vacation till at least the first week in July, because I would never bet on these people getting out of here on time.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. As always, Howie, thank you.
Have a great day.
It was big news when Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced last month that his state was busing migrants from the border to Washington, D.C. It's called Operation Lone Star, and since it began, Abbott says he has bused more than 900 migrants to the nation's capital as part of the program, and in an attempt to get the attention of lawmakers and the Biden administration, as he says the situation at the border is getting worse. Now, Governor Doug Ducey announced Arizona is doing the same, but his announcement was very different from the political show Abbott put on. Stacey Bartschinger broke the story for the Arizona Republic, and I spoke with her more about it.
There are already a group of nonprofits, non-government organizations that pick up asylum seekers and will take them to their family members, across the country if they have a sponsor, someone they're trying to get to here in the United States. The state of Arizona is now stepping in to help move some people because according to the governor's office, you know, there is this crush of demand. And as the nonprofit said, this supposed incoming crush of demand if Title 42 is lifted. So just more people are going to be relying on these services in southern Arizona and more people need to get elsewhere.
And so they're busing 20 or 30 migrants at a time to Washington, D.C. Why?
Well, that's a great question, because these 20, 30 individuals, you know, that's not their final destination. This program that Governor Ducey has unveiled is very similar to a program in Texas that Governor Greg Abbott unveiled maybe a month or so ago. Mm-hmm. And this is these governor's response and sort of physical objection to the lifting of Title 42. Mm. You know, they previously have been very frustrated at the Biden administration for not doing more at the border. The Biden administration is fighting to lift Title 42, which, you know, is a public health policy, but it has the effect of more people will want to come to the United States and be here. And so these governors are taking whatever steps they can to kind of put pressure on the Biden administration to say, like, you know, we object, you need to do more to help us with the influx of people coming in.
Yeah. So they're bringing them there. Tell us a little bit, Stacey, about just who these migrants are. Ducey's office said they're volunteers.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a really important distinction. So when I was speaking to the governor's spokesman about details of this program, the people who take these state paid, I should add, bus trips to Washington, D.C. are doing so voluntarily. The state has no authority to mandate that someone who crosses into the United States here in Arizona take them anywhere. And so it's just very important for the state to say this is a voluntary program. People can, you know, climb aboard the buses if they want. And, you know, there are a lot of resources available on the buses, like food is being provided. They're swapping out drivers every 6 hours, being very safe. And there's medical staff on board, too, just in case anything should go wrong.
Let's talk about cost there, which you just mentioned. This is, as you said, state funded. What's it costing the state?
We don't know yet because the state has a contract with a private transportation and healthcare provider to do this. They have not said how much it will cost. Somewhat that will be determined on how many people, you know, ultimately take Governor Ducey up on this offer for transportation. They had said they're going to do 2 or 3 buses a week. But, you know, if there's demand for several months, that's obviously going to cost more than, you know, if this is like a 1 week thing. It is interesting. CJ Caremargin, the spokesman for the governor, says that the state wants to recoup the costs from the White House, from the Biden administration, which is just a big open question about whether that will actually happen or if this will end up costing Arizona taxpayers.
So one thing that I thought was interesting about this story, Stacey, is that, you know, this is really softly rolled out here. Like Ducey kind of made a mention of this in another press release. It was not the big announcement, the big sort of political announcement that Texas Governor Greg Abbott made when he announced this similar program there. Why did Ducey take this approach?
So the stated reason for why they didn't make any sort of bigger announcement about this new transportation program was that the governor doesn't like spectacles. That's how his spokesman said it to me. And it certainly is true that when Texas began this program, it was a big story. I saw Fox News was like traveling with the buses, covered it when the first bus arrived in Washington, D.C. It definitely was a big deal, a big story. But the governor holds press conferences at the border often. This is a very important issue to him. He creates attention at the border when he wants to. So it definitely is odd that this new and potentially costly program was sort of buried in a press release. It was a one paragraph announcement. I think one of the reasons why it may have been sort of a soft launch, so to speak, is when Greg Abbott did this in Texas, it was very controversial. There was immediate pushback just because of the politics around immigration and border security right now. And then even from the Customs and Border Patrol commissioner, who, of course, is the former Tucson police chief, Chris Magnus, he put out a statement saying, you know, this really makes it harder for us to work with asylum seekers who need to appear in court and go through immigration proceedings. So a lot of pushback there. And I wonder if maybe the governor was trying to avoid that or at least be more careful with it. You know, also in all this conversation about this is a voluntary program, we're not forcing anyone to leave. I think that's another signal that, you know, he wanted to approach this in a more measured and very different way than Governor Abbott.
All right. That is Stacey Bartschinger, state politics reporter for the Arizona Republic, joining us to tell us more about this program. Stacey, thank you for your reporting. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, CBD products are for sale everywhere, but some are concerned about what's actually in them.
We've also had questions more empirically asking, well, what is the likelihood that if I take a CBD product, that it could cause a false positive?
We'll ask the unanswered questions about CBD.
But first, the CDC estimates that a majority of Americans have been infected with the novel coronavirus since 2020. But there are people who've avoided it so far, and scientists are trying to figure out how and why. I spoke earlier about that with Felicia Goodrum, a professor at the University of Arizona specializing in virology. She's also the president of the American Society for Virology. And I started by asking if there's any kind of consensus as to why some people that have been exposed to SARS-CoV-2 haven't developed COVID, or whether there are too many potential factors and maybe not enough time has passed to really have a good sense of it.
Probably the latter is most true. I think some people have really good mitigation practices. So for example, I, to my knowledge, have not had SARS-CoV-2, nor has anyone in my lab of about 13 people. Further, no one in my family that I know of, in my immediate family household, has had SARS-CoV-2. And so I think that is probably mostly due to mitigation, since that large group of people doesn't share genetics. However, some people have probably avoided the virus by other means, such as some biological basis.
I want to ask you about one of the phrases that you used just a moment ago, to your knowledge. And when we're looking at estimates of how many people have had COVID, it seems like one of the challenges would be there must be some number of people who got it, were totally asymptomatic, and maybe even now still don't know that they actually had it.
Exactly. And even if they weren't completely asymptomatic, maybe they just thought they had a little bit of allergies or something like that that never prompted them to take a COVID test. So I think that it's possible that many people had inapparent infections that were never detected. And now, even going back, we may not be able to detect the signature of that infection because we may not be able to measure antibodies that remain.
Does that pose challenges in terms of trying to figure out why folks who haven't gotten it didn't, especially when you're looking at maybe there are genetic or biologic reasons for it?
It does. It definitely is one of the bigger challenges in trying to figure that piece out.
For folks who really have not gotten COVID, and, you know, maybe the mitigation measures played a role, but maybe there might be some other reason as well. What are some of the options for genetic or biologic or other kinds of reasons why people maybe were exposed to COVID-19 and just didn't get infected?
Yeah, that is a great and very interesting question. And I think one of the things that drives a lot of scientists in virology to understand, some people get very sick and other people not at all with almost any virus infection. And so a couple of examples I think that, you know, are pertinent that come to mind is, for example, by the time someone becomes HIV positive, we think that that individual has probably been exposed to the virus many, many times, on the order of more than 10 times prior to actually acquiring an infection. The same thing is true for flu. I mean, you see many people that will get flu almost every year. Some people get flu only once or twice in their lifetimes. And so we don't really understand the basis of that. And so there can be something specific for that particular virus, or it can be something that's actually much less specific that can apply to any virus infection. And so, for example, we have layered immune responses that respond to any viral infection. And so there's the innate response, which is your first line of response that will respond very non-specifically to any virus. And this produces an interferon response. It can result in fever. And these responses would be non-specific. Some of us may have heightened innate responses that are better able to limit an initial viral infection and clear that virus before we even know we've been infected, whereas other people don't. And so people have quite a range in the way that they respond to virus infections. The same virus over multiple people, you'll see different immune responses, to where some people won't be infected, other people will be infected. Of those people that are infected, some people will get really sick and some people not at all.
Why is it important to know why some people just don't seem to get COVID-19?
Well, it's very important to know and understand these biological bases because they inform how we learn to fight infections through the development of antivirals and vaccines. And so we learn when we know how people develop, have greater resistance to viruses, we learn in how we're developing vaccines or antivirals for future infections.
So it in theory can lead to maybe more effective, more targeted prevention and even treatment methods.
Yes, absolutely.
In the world of virology, how big of a topic of research, topic of conversation is this right now?
It is a big topic, but it always has been. And so I don't feel like SARS-CoV-2 has really heightened that at all. The things we've seen with SARS-CoV-2 are very similar to what we've really understood about viruses in general. And so in my laboratory, we study a herpes virus. And one of the best known herpes viruses is herpes simplex 1 that causes cold sores. And what we know is that about 70% of the U.S. population carries herpes simplex 1. However, 70% of the population does not get cold sores. Of those that do get cold sores, some may get one cold sore, two cold sores for their entire life. Other people will get cold sores nearly every month. And so it's the same virus infecting a human host with very different outcomes. And so we really do want to understand what defines those differences in outcome. And we think that it is really the initial interaction between the virus and the host that sets up that infection, that in the case of a herpes virus would be for the life of that individual, not true for a virus like SARS-CoV-2, but still the outcome of a SARS-CoV-2 infection is going to really probably depend very much on that initial interaction. What I mean by that initial interaction is that it's going to depend on how much virus you're being infected with, what is the state of your health at the time you're infected, and then how quickly is that innate immune response that really is your first line of defense in any virus infection, how quickly and how robustly is it going to respond to that infection?
Do you think it's possible that there will be some people who just never actually are infected with SARS-CoV-2 and never develop COVID-19?
That is possible. So, for example, with HIV, some people carry a mutation in the receptor to which HIV binds. And so then they are essentially immune to becoming infected with HIV. It isn't something that, you know, I would trust to 100% that, you know, may exist for SARS-CoV-2 and that there are people that don't have to worry about the potential for becoming infected. But I guess part of what people are trying to do is to understand if there are any underlying biological bases for people who just simply seem not to become infected with SARS-CoV-2, even though they've been highly exposed. And so this has been in the case of some healthcare workers who seem to be completely refractory to becoming infected with SARS-CoV-2. And so they could contain a mutation in a gene that the virus needs to either enter the cell or replicate in the cell that now no longer allows the virus to do that.
All right. That is Felicia Goodrum, a professor of virology at the University of Arizona, also president of the American Society for Virology. Felicia, thanks for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has had a lot of ripple effects, and everything from Finland and Sweden's decision to apply for NATO membership, which is expected to happen this week, to where some countries get their energy. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the days to come is the BBC's Rich Preston. And Rich, on Wednesday, leaders from various European countries will be meeting in Denmark for important talks about energy. What's the story there?
That's right, Mark. This is called the North Sea Summit. It's seeing leaders and climate ministers from Denmark, Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands gathering together. And this is all about how they can capitalize on one energy source that is in abundance in the North Sea, and that is wind. Now, there are already a few wind farms in the North Sea, particularly around the coasts just off the north of Germany and the west of Denmark. But experts say there's ample opportunity for more. And let me tell you, as someone who grew up on the outskirts of Aberdeen in the northeast of Scotland on the North Sea, it's a very, very windy place. The problem is, Mark, there are two big hurdles. One is cost, one is infrastructure. Now, the North Sea is a harsh environment. So building things which can withstand the abuse they'll get out in the deeper North Sea is going to take some considerable upfront cost and take a lot of engineering effort to make the things and to get them in place. But there are two big factors providing the impetus for this change as well. One is climate, obviously, plenty of wind here, absolutely a green energy that is, as I say, in abundance. The North Sea was once famous for its oil and gas reserves. Maybe, who knows, in the future it can be as famous for its wind reserves. The second is Russia. Now, the invasion of Ukraine, the sanctions imposed on Russia, has meant Europe wants to get away from Russian oil and gas as completely as it can, as quickly as it can. It may be the case that wind is just the way forward on that. That meeting is on Wednesday.
Interesting. All right, Rich, let's go to Australia now, where Australians will be going to the polls at over the weekend in a national election. Who's in the running and what should we be paying attention to there?
Well, the current Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is looking to secure a fourth term in office with his right-wing Liberal National Coalition government. His main opposition is the left-wing Labour Party under the leadership of Anthony Albanese. There are 17 million eligible voters across Australia. Now, a few key issues here. COVID is one. Now, Scott Morrison locked Australia down pretty early, pretty tightly. Flights were banned. People couldn't leave the country. It was also a struggle for Australians abroad to get home. And if you were one of the lucky few who managed to get on a flight back, well, you had 14 days in government-run quarantine with armed guards at your hotel door to make sure you didn't leave. The upside of that was it kept COVID largely out of Australia. You know, it hasn't had the infection and fatality rates anywhere near like the rest of the world. And that meant a lot of aspects of ordinary life for most Australians continued as normal for much of the 2 years. You know, eating out, parties, sporting events. And it seems that many Australians were pretty happy with that. There were several votes held during the pandemic and lawmakers from the governing party were repeatedly, successively voted back into office. That worked in Scott Morrison's favour, obviously, and helped boost the economy, which has stayed pretty buoyant. The opposition Labour Party has criticised the government for its slow procurement of COVID vaccines, and it says it wants to defend the national healthcare system and provide better and cheaper childcare facilities. The thing is, Mark, as we've seen elsewhere in the world, lots of people are going away from the traditional two parties, and many are opting for outsider candidates. And one of those in Australia is the Green Party. Now, one thing that is seen as a big failure of Scott Morrison's government is its green credentials. Australia has a big coal mining industry, which Scott Morrison repeatedly said he would protect. Now, we're talking about a country here that has devastating bushfires, the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef, and, you know, droughts year on year and scorching temperatures to go with it. So a bit of a bone of contention there. And with COVID hopefully behind us and the Aussie economy bobbing along nicely, it's thought that many Australians might consider this a time to vote for issues like climate change instead. One final point on this, a reminder, Australia is one of the few countries that has mandatory voting laws. If you're an Australian citizen and you don't vote, it's a fine or jail time for you.
So, Rich, finally staying in that part of the world, President Biden is due to visit South Korea and Japan later this week. What's on the agenda there and what's significant about that trip?
Well, he's going to be meeting the leaders from both countries. In fact, South Korea's president, Yoon Suk-yeol, was only sworn in 6 days ago, so a big first week in office for him meeting the US president. And this is ultimately about reiterating ties between the US and these two Asian countries. Now, timing is pretty significant here, Mark. It comes off the back of North Korea carrying out several missile launches and weapons tests. None that America should be concerned about, but it's a bit of kind of muscle flexing in the region. You know, when these missiles fly into the Sea of Japan, Tokyo doesn't like that for obvious reasons. And when the trip was announced, the White House said this was about advancing the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific. There is a quid pro quo here, though. The US is looking for support from South Korea and Japan, especially when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. Basically, Joe Biden wants more people in his corner than President Putin has in his. Now, that's particularly relevant when it comes to Japan. You know, we forget how big a country Russia is. It stretches all the way to Japan. They are sitting across each other just over the Sea of Japan, and Japan's northernmost island, Sapporo, is at its closest just 30 miles from Russian territory. They are very, very close. Russia and Japan generally on okay terms, but President Biden wants Tokyo's support when it comes to sanctions. He's also expected to announce the launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. That's basically about countering China's influence in Asia. That was built out of the rubble of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which President Trump pulled the US away from. And he's also, while he's there, going to be meeting with what's called the Quad Group leaders. The Quad Group is made up of the US, Australia, Japan, and India. Now, what's interesting about this is how this is being played out in Chinese media. Now, the South China Morning Post, state-controlled, of course, talks about Japan having a dim view of the US's strategy in the region. And the Global Times says India is unhappy with various elements of US foreign policy and says President Biden will be hyping the China threat and that India will be looking to make use of its border disputes, quote, for its own interests. So, ahead of the US president's visit to the region and these meetings, China trying to sow a bit of doubt and discontent and basically undermine the meetings that Joe Biden is going to be having.
All right, that is the BBC's Rich Preston in London. Rich, as always, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. Senator John McCain passed away in 2018, but he was back in the headlines over the past few days. One story featured GOP gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake declaring that McCain was, quote, reaching up from the grave trying to keep power in Arizona. The other found former McCain advisor Steve Schmidt feuding with the late senator's daughter Megan on social media. Phil Boas of The Republic wrote about Schmidt's comments in a Sunday column and spoke with our co-host Steve Goldstein about it.
Steve Schmidt used to be, he had been the one of the campaign strategists, an important aide on John McCain's presidential run in 2008. And he took this moment in this past week to really tee off on John McCain and to sort of empty out the skeletons in the closet from that 2008 run. And he made a bunch of allegations. He basically said that McCain had lied to the nation when he claimed that he didn't have a romantic relationship with a Beltway lobbyist way back when. And he also said that it was McCain who was fully responsible for the pick of Sarah Palin, which turned out to be a disaster. And even though Schmidt acknowledges that he was, the first to say that the campaign ought to consider her, he wasn't really involved in the hard questioning of her that he says would have revealed, you know, what a problem she was, her lack of knowledge of the issues, her lack of depth.
Now, are you arguing in the column that sort of discretion is the better part of valor, that Schmidt should have just kept quiet as opposed to promoting his Substack? Or do you think that his venting his spleen is not truly honest?
Well, Schmidt he's one of the founders of the Lincoln Project, which was really a bunch of Republican political operatives who turned on the Republican nominee, Donald Trump, and basically went to work against him try to get him defeated in the last election. And they were working from the Democratic side, basically attacking him at every turn. And it was just, I felt it was disingenuous the way Schmidt was coming at McCain and really going after Meghan McCain, accusing her of basically, ridiculing and attacking him constantly, for many, many years, and portraying himself as a victim, as her victim. And it just, for me, it's not believable. This is a guy who's been a hired gun for campaigns and political causes and things for many, many years. You know, he's been in the arena, and I just don't, I find it hard to believe that the weepy victim tale that he spins in kind of this vainglorious language that is like 16th century nutty. I described him as Norma Desmond with a Twitter feed. And others were saying, Jonah Goldberg over the weekend was basically saying, does no one close to Steve Schmidt like or love him enough to tell him to walk away from Twitter for even a little while? The guy needs some friends. This is sad. So others were recognizing that he was coming off unhinged on Twitter, the way he was attacking the McCain family, the McCain legacy.
Well, so let's talk about victim versus bully, because you use those words in there too, where Schmidt is acting like the victim, but he's actually acting like a bully. Explain that from your perspective, would you?
Yeah, it's that expression, the cry bully. You know, at the time he is beating up Meghan McCain and talking about what a spoiled little brat she was when she was a young woman, you know, on the campaign, and how he, you know, he would never want his own child to grow up like Meghan McCain. I mean, he's just batting her over the head over and over and over with stuff on Twitter in his little Substack screed. And then he claims to be her victim. Just not believable. Just kind of silly, actually.
Well, Phil, big picture, let's talk a little bit about the late Senator McCain. Steve Schmidt bringing up the 2008 campaign. But now we also have GOP gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake claiming in a podcast that Senator McCain is trying to, I'm not going verbatim here, but basically rule the state Republican Party from the grave. We used to hear references to Barry Goldwater all the time, but they tended to be more positive. Why do you think McCain is still in the spotlight this way? Why is he brought up either for good or bad reasons?
Well, the crazy wing, which has taken over the Republican Party in Arizona, but the crazy wing of the Republican Party always hated John McCain. They never liked him, and they censured him. They were constantly attacking him, and they didn't like anybody who would reach across the aisle, who looked for compromise. And that's who McCain was. McCain was trying to solve problems. He wasn't an ideologue, and he wasn't crazy. And so there's always been a lot of animosity coming from that side of the Republican Party. So it's not surprising that Lake, who is an acolyte of Trump, would be parrot some of that that nuttiness from the Republican Party during McCain's day in Arizona, which was very much against him.
Phil Boas of the Arizona Republic. Phil, thank you as always. Take care.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Steve.
Warmer days are here, and the snow that supplies most of the water to the Colorado River is melting. Our drought-stricken region needs all the water it can get, so as winter comes to a close in the mountains, Alex Hager tells us what we can expect for the summer in the Colorado River Basin.
In the middle of the summer, a rainy day in the arid west can feel as satisfying as a long drink in the desert. But really, those precious summer rains barely move the needle when it comes to water.
Regardless of what you get in the summer, what really impacts the water availability in the Colorado River is what happens in the winter.
That's Becky Bollinger, Colorado's assistant state climatologist. It's worth zooming in on Colorado because snow that falls high in the Rockies makes up 2/3 of the water that flows through the Colorado River, supplying 40 million people across the Southwest. So how much snow is there right now? Well, in most spots, close to 90% of normal. But not all of that snow is going to make it into the rivers.
Unfortunately, we're dealing with dry soils from the previous start of the season, meaning that a lot of that is going to recharging the soils.
Because Colorado has seen back-to-back dry years, the dirt is parched. So when snow melts on top of it, it acts like a sponge, soaking up water on its way downhill. And a lot of the snow is melting earlier than normal. Carl Wetlaufer is one of Colorado's top snow researchers. He says that early melt is partially thanks to wind, which blows dust around.
When that dust reaches the surface, it retains a lot more of the energy from the sun. So we've also seen a dramatically accelerated snowmelt pattern and resulting streamflow runoff due to that dust on the snowpack.
Between the dust, the dry soil, and the higher than normal temperatures, mountain snow won't be as helpful as the Colorado River needs it to be.
It is going to be many, many years before I think we're going to be able to get back up to any semblance of normalcy.
The region banks up a stash of water in reservoirs from Wyoming to Arizona, and those reserves are getting drained because homes and farms keep drawing water out, and the snowmelt just can't keep up.
I would definitely say that this year's snowpack is not going to be enough to substantially increase those storage values.
The thinking is the same downstream. Erin Ann Saffel is the Arizona state climatologist, where mountain snow is still the difference maker for things like underground water storage.
We really depend on our winter precipitation, the snowpack, kind of melting and moving into our groundwater more than we pay attention to or rely on what happens with our summer precipitation, because the nature of the precipitation is different.
But enough about snow. Even though it does the heavy lifting in the Colorado River Basin, what falls in the summer does still matter. It's just more subtle.
It recharges the stock ponds for the ranchers. Those kinds of things are what we pay attention to. So when we don't get that summer precipitation, there are implications.
And even back up north where the Colorado River starts, rain in the warmer months makes a difference for things like
limiting the risk for wildfires, keeping the temperatures from getting too hot, and hopefully keeping the soils from drying out too much before the start of the next snowpack season.
It's hard for climate scientists to map out the months ahead. Right now, the big question is if that summer rain will arrive when we need it.
After the memory of the snowpack is long gone and you need that summer moisture to carry you through to the fall. And that is a component that is really hard to predict far out.
What we do know, hot and dry years have been stacking up in the Colorado River Basin, and human-caused climate change is making it less and less likely that things will cool off and get wetter anytime soon. I'm Alex Hager.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced by KUNC and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Using CBD products should not get you a positive test for THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. But Banner Health's Poison Control Center says they've received an increasing number of reports from people who have failed marijuana drug tests but say they've only used CBD. There are still plenty of questions as to why, but our next guest is here to offer some theories. Dr. Brian Kuhn is a pharmacist and clinical toxicologist for the Banner Poison and Drug Information Center, and I spoke with him more about it.
So certainly with the changes in legislation in Arizona and other states over the last several years, we've generally known that cases of exposures to cannabis or CBD products was going to increase. So certainly on our end, we've done our due diligence to go through the literature and the research to determine exactly what sorts of not only clinical effects are we going to expect, but ultimately on the analytical side, so testing of these drugs, if there was any concern for the more, pure CBD products perhaps causing false positive on urine drug screens for THC. And at least initially, we didn't expect there to be this increase that we've anecdotally have been hearing about over the last couple of years. But certainly that's been the evidence, is that certainly we're getting phone calls where individuals are asking about failed drug tests, where they are under the presumption they are taking only a pure CBD product.
Right, right. So you're hearing calls from people saying, like, I tested positive for THC on a drug test. I have not smoked marijuana or exposed myself in this way. The only thing I have taken is like a CBD product, right? And that sort of, it sounds like, started to ring some alarms there.
That's correct. And so certainly some of the phone calls do start out from the scenario where someone's working from the angle of a positive urine drug screen for whatever purpose, whether it's from school or job. Mm-hmm. We've also had questions more empirically asking, well, what is the likelihood that if I take a CBD product, that it could cause a false positive on, the urine drug screen? And so we do get sort of both angles, but the sort of common point is ultimately, should CBD result in a positive urine drug screen? And it shouldn't. What the urine drug screen looks for is the inactive metabolite of delta-9 THC. So delta-9 THC is the psychoactive substance, the primary psychoactive substance we find in cannabis. Although, cannabis contains hundreds of different chemicals. And we know that delta-9 THC goes through a very specific, metabolic pathway to produce this inactive metabolite. And that's ultimately what we are looking for on a urine drug screen. CBD, cannabidiol, goes through a similar sort of metabolic pathway, but should not result in the formation of that inactive THC metabolite that we look for on the urine drug screen. And so we're not 100, no one's 100% sure exactly why this is. There's certainly different theories, but generally speaking, we do not expect CBD to cross-react and cause a false positive THC result on a urine drug screen.
Right. And certainly most, you know, consumers are not expecting that, right? So walk us through some of those theories. What do we think is probably going on here?
I mean, if I had to peg it on one thing, my guesstimate would be that these are not pure CBD products. So CBD is generally derived from what we refer to as industrial hemp. Industrial hemp, as it relates to the legislation on the 2018 Farm Bill, said that industrial hemp basically cannot contain more than, you know, 0.3% THC by content. And so, you know, growers produce hemp. Hemp is then distributed to various manufacturers who, you know, through their various processes are going to extract CBD and perhaps other materials from the hemp product. And so there's not much in the way that I'm familiar with in terms of testing once that raw material has left the farm and gone somewhere to get processed to whatever the final product is going to be. So it's entirely possible that through the manufacturing process, this, you know, distillation or purification of the CBD product, that THC components within hemp are getting concentrated, or in fact, THC is intentionally being added to the CBD product. We know there are pure or single CBD ingredient products. We know that there are combination CBD THC products. And then we know that there are pure THC products. So it really depends, you know, the knowledge of the consumer buying which specific product they're intending to buy when they go to a dispensary. And so, you know, unfortunately, what we're finding is the quality assurance, the quality control is really up to the individual, either manufacturer or dispensary. There's not a lot of external checks and controls to guarantee that when you buy a product that's labeled to only contain cannabidiol, that indeed it does.
Man, so I mean, do you think, in your opinion, there should be more screening, more regulation of this, essentially, because, you know, the consumer can't be sure of what they're getting?
I don't think it's a bad idea. I mean, certainly as a pharmacist, you know, medications that we are given in hospitals or prescribed by our physicians go through rigorous, not only the initial sort of safety and efficacy analysis of that drug, but, you know, post-marketing surveillance and the manufacturing of those drugs are under very significant manufacturing standards that are regularly checked upon by federal agencies. And so I don't think it's a bad idea, especially when we're talking about a substance that we're trying to derive some sort of therapeutic benefit from, and perhaps we get variable responses because we're taking different products, you know, from one month to the next that we buy at different dispensaries. Yeah. So it would be nice to have some sort of standardization or regulation. I don't know that that's ever going to happen, at least in the same sort of context we see, you know, prescription medications or over-the-counter medications go through.
Hmm. All right. That is Dr. Brian Kuhn, a pharmacist and clinical toxicologist for the Banner Poison and Drug Information Center. Dr. Kuhn, thank you for coming on. Thank you for explaining this. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for your time and having me.
Well, that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, of course, as always, for tuning in and listening. We sure hope you'll be back with us tomorrow morning for more news from around the valley and across the region. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening. Have a great rest of your day. See you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody and Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening today.